As you probably already guessed, it must be time for new batteries in the clicker this morning. It's not keeping pace. Maybe if it's close enough here, we'll be all right. Lori just reminded me I didn't give her a copy of my notes, so I'm way behind the eight ball today. So probably most of you recognize this as the lawman everyone loves, Barney Fife. Lawman extraordinaire. There wasn't a situation that Barney Fife couldn't handle or thought that he couldn't handle. There's an episode of the Andy Griffith Show, and you may remember this if you've watched the reruns, or some of you are probably old enough to have seen it when it first aired. But there's an episode where Barney confronts two truck farmers who are selling their vegetables without a permit. Two pretty tough guys, and as you know, Barney wasn't very big. He was wiry, but not very big. Barney goes up to these two people, and with his usual swagger and bravado, he tells them to leave, but they refuse. In fact, by the time that encounter's over, Barney's running back to the car, kind of shouting over his shoulder, but they basically threaten him, and they run him off. They intimidate the smaller deputy and laugh as they chase him back to his car. Andy, of course, spends the rest of this show trying to restore his deputy's lost confidence. In fact, somewhere about in the middle, Andy even makes his mistakes. He goes out and kind of tells him, you know, that you better watch out for this Fife guy, in fact. And they get scared and about to run out of town, but they run into Floyd the barber. And of course, they tell him that Andy was just lying to him. Barney wasn't that tough. So Barney hides the rest of the time. He's doing everything he can think of to get out of going back and confronting him, but Andy knows that he needs to do it. Eventually, he tells Barney, you know, you've got to do this, and he gives them his speech about the badge that he wears. He says, that's the authority that you have as a lawman. He goes back and faces the two men, and they start into their swagger as well, thinking he's going to run this time. But he stands his ground. He's scared, you can tell it. You know, he's not speaking very loud, his voice quivering a little, but he says, you know, you may be bigger than I am. You may be able to, I'm not probably quoting it exactly, you may be able to beat me up, but you can't run from the badge. That's the authority. And they eventually back down and load up their stuff and go off. And of course, the episode ends. Barney's got his swagger back, you know. He starts waltzing back to the car like he's pretty tough again. Barney started out by having the wrong authority. He thought, well, just on the basis of who he was, he could handle that, but he couldn't. He had to find the right source of authority. The world's full of the wrong kinds of authority. The Bible gives us evidences of the people trying to use the wrong kinds of authority. Here's some examples. Some try to exert their authority through domination, right? Just sheer overpowering of others. We see that among the Jewish leadership, in fact, in Matthew chapter 20. Matthew chapter 20. Let me just read something that happens in the life of Jesus and those that were opposing him. Matthew chapter 20, starting in verse 25. Here Jesus is using the example of the world around them, and he's teaching his disciples something about leadership and authority. Matthew chapter 20, starting in verse 25, says, Jesus called them to himself and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. This idea of lording it over, that's domination. Lording it over somebody. Nobody likes that. Jesus says, it is not this way among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. Jesus says, I don't want that type of authority used among my followers. None of my people are to lord it over anybody. That's the wrong kind of authority. Then you've got authority by association, another wrong kind of authority. This is the authority that says, well, I'm part of a certain group. That means I've got authority over you. And there are times, of course, when even like Deputy Fife, right? He was part of the law fraternity, and that by virtue of that fact gave him some authority. But notice what happens in John chapter 7. John chapter 7, verses 47 and 48. In verse 45, we've got the Jewish leadership had sent out some people to arrest Jesus. It says the officers came to the chief priests and Pharisees, and they said to them, "Why did you not bring him?" Speaking of Jesus. The officers answered, "Never has a man spoken the way this man speaks." Notice the answer of the Pharisees. It says, the Pharisees answered and said, "You have not also been led astray, have you? No one of the rulers or Pharisees has believed in him, has he?" What are they doing? It's authority by association. Well, the Pharisees don't believe in Jesus, so guess what? Nobody else should. Then you've got authority by degradation. Authority by degradation is just putting someone else down. If I can't exert myself over you, I'll put you down enough so that I have some sort of authority. This is also in John chapter 7, if you're still there. This time a couple verses down, verses 49 through 52. But this crowd, which does not know the law, is accursed. Nicodemus, who came to him before, being one of them, said to them, "Our law does not judge a man unless it first hears from him and knows what he is doing, does it?" They answered him, "You are not also from Galilee, are you? Search and see that no prophet arises out of Galilee." And everyone went to his home. Authority by degradation. See the cutting remarks they make? "You're not from Galilee too," as if the Galileans were somehow a lower class of people. "I've got authority over you because you're not of the right social strata." Putting people down. That's the wrong kind of authority. And then you've got a favorite one, authority by intimidation. If I can't reason with you according to my supposed superior intellect, I'll just intimidate you to the point where I've got power over you. This is what the Jewish leaders try to use in John chapter 9. Here Jesus healed a man born blind, and that throws the leaders of Jesus' time into a fit. They're trying to get to the bottom of it. In chapter 9 and verse 22, they confront the blind man's parents. Verse 20, we'll start there. His parents answered them and said, We do know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but how he now sees, we do not know. Or who opened his eyes, we do not know. Ask him, he is of age. He will speak for himself. Now notice why they answered this way. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone confessed him to be Christ or Messiah, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Those are intimidation tactics, right? Well, you either agree with us or we're putting you out. You can't be part of this group. Peer pressure. Intimidation. Now, you probably don't have to think very long in your own life to think of times when you've encountered this type of authority. Sadly, this type of authority is exercised in some religious groups and churches. It's the wrong kind of authority. Maybe at work, maybe at school, whatever, you're familiar with the wrong kind of authority. Everyone's encountered it, been abused by it. Or sadly, maybe we've abused others with this kind of authority. Those are the wrong kinds of authority. The kind of authority Barney tried to use the first time, and he learned better from it. We see a different model in the life of Jesus, though, don't we? In Matthew chapter 8, we find Jesus exerting a new kind of authority, if you will. Not new in the fact that it had just been invented or discovered, but Jesus goes about exerting authority in the right way. Do you ever remember Jesus dominating someone? That wasn't his style. That wasn't his ministry. Do you ever remember Jesus dominating over someone else or exerting authority by saying, well, you're just not part of my group, so you don't belong here? He never degraded anybody. He never intimidated. Now, Jesus, I believe, was an intimidating figure in some situations. I can't imagine arguing with the Son of God like some of the leaders did in his day. But Jesus never used intimidation. No, Jesus exercised kingdom authority in a different kind of way, just by doing things right. Just saying what, doing what the Father wanted done and just doing it. Going about his business. A person with true authority doesn't have to flaunt it, do they? No. It's usually the ones that are doing all the bragging and blustering and posturing. Those are the ones that know they don't have the authority to do what they're doing, but they're putting up a front. Jesus never operated that way. We see that, of course, in Matthew, chapter 8. If you want to turn to that chapter, we'll read through these verses and notice the style of Jesus as far as authority. Every realm of life, we have an example here, really, in this chapter of Jesus showing who's in charge. Not in a bragging type of way, but there was no doubt when Jesus was done who was ultimately in charge or had been given the power to exercise authority. First of all, Jesus shows that he has power over disease. Wouldn't that be nice? To live in a world or know someone who just by a prayer or a touch of a hand or just by saying the word could heal someone. Jesus had that kind of power and authority. In chapter 8, verses 1 through 4, when Jesus came down from the mountain, large crowds followed him, and a leper came to him and bowed down before him and said, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, I am willing, be cleansed. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said to him, see that you tell no one, but go show yourself to the priest and present the offering that Moses commanded as a testimony to them. Isn't that amazing? What kind of authority is this that Jesus says, I am willing, be cleansed, and it happens? Terrible disease. Leprosy. Didn't stop the Son of God. Spoke the word, and it was done immediately. A little bit later in the chapter, verses 14 through 17, we've got Peter's mother-in-law was lying sick in a bed with a fever. Jesus touched her. The fever left her, and she got up and waited on Jesus and the others. And then, of course, verses 16 and 17 speak of what often occurred in the life of Jesus. People were thronging to him, thinking in their minds, this is a person with true authority. Disease, illness are no match for the Son of God. Jesus had authority over disease. Jesus exercised authority over space. Verses 5 through 13, Jesus encounters a centurion, a soldier whose servant was lying paralyzed at home. Jesus says, I'll come and heal him. And this centurion exhibited great faith by saying, he says, you know, I know something about authority. In fact, in verse 8 it says, but the centurion said, Lord, I am not worthy for you to come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. Maybe he had heard something about that first healing. Verse 9, for I am also a man under authority with soldiers under me, and I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and he does it. And Jesus marveled at such great faith. Jesus marveled that this centurion, a Gentile, would have enough faith to say, you know, you don't even have to be there. Just say the word and it will be done. What is Jesus exhibiting there? Later, if you go on and read, he went home and found out it was just like Jesus said it would be. Jesus has authority over space, the space-time continuum, if you will. Jesus didn't have to even be there physically and touch the person to heal them. That's true authority. That's power. Jesus could have chosen to heal someone halfway around the world if he'd have wanted. Space is no limitation for this kind of authority. Thirdly, in this chapter, we see authority over terms. What does that mean? In verses 18 and 22 through 22, we've got Jesus talking about discipleship. Then a scribe, verse 19, came and said to him, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus, in essence, tells the man, "You better sit down and count the cost. The foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Another of his disciples came to him and said, "Lord, permit me to first go and bury my father." But Jesus said to him, "Follow me and allow the dead to bury their own dead." What's Jesus doing there? What's he saying about the terms of discipleship? Jesus makes the rules. Jesus sets the terms. If you're going to follow me, this is the way it's going to have to be. He's not bargaining here with these disciples, is he? He's not sitting down and saying, "Okay, well, let's work this out. I'll give a little, you give a little, and we'll make this thing work." No, Jesus kindly says, "This is the way it's going to be. If you're going to be my disciple, here's the cost." Jesus has authority over the terms. He's the one that sets those terms. Then a great account, verses 23 through 27, Jesus shows authority over nature. He gets into a boat with his disciples. They're on the sea there, and a great storm comes up. Looks like they're going to be shipwrecked. Jesus is sleeping through it all. They shake Jesus, wake him up. "Lord, we're perishing." "Why are you afraid?" Jesus says. Then he got up and rebuked the winds and the sea, and they became perfectly calm. The men were amazed and said, "What kind of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him?" That's a great question. The answer is, that's a man with great authority. Jesus speaks and people are healed. Jesus speaks and people are healed over a great distance. Jesus speaks and sets the terms. Jesus speaks and nature itself bows before his power. The winds die down. The seas become calm. Finally, for this chapter, we see authority over even the demonic world. You know, the world is Satan's realm. This is Satan's playground, this world we live in. That's why things are in such a mess in so many corners of our world. But that doesn't mean that someone isn't ultimately in authority over even sets the limits for Satan himself. In verses 28 through 34, the last section of the chapter, Jesus comes to the country of the Gadarenes, met there by a demon-possessed man. You read some of this account in some of the other Gospels, and this was a man that had terrified the people who lived in that area. Possessed by demons himself, Jesus casts the demon out. That's great authority. Great authority. Satan himself is no match for the Son of God. That's a different style of authority, isn't it? No fanfare. Jesus encounters all of these situations, all of these different areas of life, and speaks a word, and it's done. Or speaks a word, and that's just the way it's going to be. That's true authority. Again, Jesus doesn't have to intimidate, dominate, associate with a particular group, or degrade anyone. Reminds me of verses like Matthew 28, verse 18. As Jesus prepares after his death, burial, and resurrection to go back to the Father and send the Spirit Jesus reminds his disciples, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. You know what that means? There's no authority left for me, you or me. Jesus didn't say, I have 99% of authority, but you have 1%. He doesn't share his authority that way at all. All authority has been given to me. Jesus can delegate some things if he chooses to, but he possesses all authority. Also shortly before his death, John 17, as Jesus prays to the Father, he says, Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that the Son may glorify you, even as you gave him authority over all flesh, that to all whom you have given him, he may give eternal life. Jesus has authority over all flesh, whether we like it or not. Acts chapter 2, verse 36, Jesus has gone back to the Father by this time. Now Peter and the rest of the apostles are preaching on the day of Pentecost in Jerusalem. He gets to the crucial point in his sermon. Here's the point, Peter says. Therefore, let all the house of Israel know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. There's an uh-oh moment. You ever wonder why the crowd cried out? Realizing what they'd done, they says, we've just murdered the one who had all authority. The one who is Lord and Christ, Master and Messiah. That's Jesus. Paul in Romans 14 says, for to this end Christ died and lived again, that he might be Lord both of the dead and of the living. You see, the realm of Jesus' authority covers everything. Everything, everywhere, everybody. Lord of the dead and the living. The question we need to ask ourselves then is, what are we going to do with the authority of Jesus? You see, that's our choice. What are we going to do about it? What are we going to do with the fact that Jesus has all authority in heaven and on earth, of the dead and the living, over me, over you? Are we going to ignore it? That's a choice you have. You can try to ignore the authority of Jesus. Or maybe you're fighting it. You know, some of us are rebels at heart. Well, all of us are rebels at heart in one layer or another. Some of us relish rebelness more than others. But maybe that's your attitude toward the one with all authority. Maybe you've just never been able to knuckle under anybody's authority. And now you've got the Son of God saying, I've got authority over you. Maybe you're still fighting the authority of Jesus. Maybe we're just ridiculing it. Rather than fighting against it, maybe you're the type of person that just, well, you know, that's kind of a funny way to do things. It's popular to ridicule religion these days, so we shouldn't be surprised when some people ridicule the statements of Scripture about Jesus having all authority. Ignoring it, fighting it, ridiculing it. I would suggest this morning the best way to deal with the authority of Jesus is to submit to it. Submit to it. You can't change it anyway. The Bible says in Philippians chapter 2 that every knee will bow. I will kneel before the King of the universe one day. I can do it willingly or unwillingly. The same is true for you. But what are you going to do with the authority of Jesus? Think about that. This picture doesn't come out as well on the screen as it does on the computer. But if you can make that out, that's a naval vessel. Got some naval officers standing there on the deck, but it's in a fog. Dangerous. I'm no naval person, but my guess is it's a little more dangerous to sail in the fog than it is when the weather's clear. This story is shared by Max Lucado in one of his books. You may have heard it before, but it makes a good point. And this is from the record of the U.S. Naval Institute Proceedings. Sounds like an official magazine to me. Probably makes more sense to a sailor than others. But in this particular issue, Frank Coe illustrates the importance of obeying the laws of the lighthouse. And notice how the account goes, or how he shares the story. Two battleships were assigned to a training squadron that had been at sea on maneuvers in heavy weather for several days. I was serving on the lead battleship and was on watch on the bridge as night fell. The visibility was poor with patchy fog, so the captain remained on the bridge keeping an eye on all activities. You've got to have all hands on deck when you're sailing, I'm guessing, in this kind of weather. People need to be paying attention. Shortly after dark, the lookout on the wing reported, "Light bearing on the starboard bow." And don't ask me what starboard is. It's the side of the boat. "Is it steady or moving astern?" the captain called out. The lookout replied, "Steady, Captain," which meant that we were on a dangerous collision course with that other ship. The captain then called to the signalman. "Signal that ship," he ordered. "We are on a collision course. Advise them to change their course 20 degrees. Back came the signal. "Advise for you to change your course 20 degrees. The captain said, "Send this message. I'm a captain. Change your course 20 degrees. "I'm a seaman second class," came the reply. "You had better change your course 20 degrees. By that time, obviously, the captain was furious. You see, a seaman second class doesn't give a captain orders. By that time, the captain was furious. He spat out, "Send this message. I'm a battleship. Change course 20 degrees. Back came the flashing signal. "Change your course 20 degrees. I'm a lighthouse." So we changed course. Now that's a humorous story, but makes an important point, you see. No amount of authority makes a difference if you're on collision course with a lighthouse, if you're a naval vessel. And I wonder if sometimes that doesn't illustrate the course of our lives, you see. We are on a collision course with the authority of Jesus Christ. I am, you are. But it's almost as if we get to arguing with the Lord. "You change your course, Lord, and I'll follow you then." Jesus says, "No, this is the course. If you want to follow me, these are the terms you need to change." But all the struggling, all the posturing we can do isn't going to change the fact that Jesus has all authority in heaven and on earth. It's our course that needs to change. Think about the changes that might be necessary in your life, and I'll think in my life as well. If you're not a disciple of Jesus, of course, that's obviously a needed course correction, you see, because living for myself isn't going to get it done. Might be the way I like to live, might be what I choose to do, but ultimately, my eternity hinges on whether I submit to the authority of Jesus Christ. I would encourage you to look in your own life. If you haven't made the choice to submit to Jesus, to his authority, then I would encourage you to take steps this morning, or start taking steps this morning to alter that course. Change your course. Study what God has to say about that change. See what surrendering your life entails. And I'm not going to pretend this morning that changes won't need to be made, that some of those changes are difficult. Like Jesus told some of the men in John or Matthew chapter 8, you know, it's not all roses. There is tough parts to that submission. But yet it's the only way we'll avoid the catastrophe of facing eternity without God. Consider that call as we stand and sing.